are listening to a free version of The Majority Report with Sam Steeder. To support this show and get another 15 minutes of daily program, go to majority.fm, please.
The Majority Report with Sam Steeder, where every day is casual Friday. That means Monday is casual Monday. Tuesday, casual Tuesday. Wednesday, casual hump day. Thursday, casual Thurs. That's what we call it. And Friday, casual Shabbat. The Majority Report with Sam Steeder.
It is Friday, February 27th, 2015. My name is Sam Steeder. This is the three-time award-winning Majority Report. We are broadcasting live steps from the industrially ravaged Gowanus Canal in the heartland of America, downtown Brooklyn, USA. It's Casual Friday, folks. You know what that means. Cliff Schechter will be here to look back on this week. And I guess theoretically look forward. And even sideways. Or, I guess, contemporaneously. Also on the program today, Film Guy Matthew with a film recommendation. In fact, also, I guess, what will happen with Matthew and I, we're going to talk a lot about my week taping, shooting Marc Maron's IFC show and my moment in his garage. That's right. WTF. Podcast. Finally. My own hour. Also on the program today, moments ago, the Senate passed a Homeland Security bill as the House GOP are hoping to pass a stopgap funding bill. Also on the program, Scott Walker tries to make an argument that he will be tough with ISIS because, of course, he faced down the protesters in
Wisconsin. I think if I dealt with a drum circle, I could deal with a terrorist.
That's right.
Also on the program today, net neutrality wins big yesterday. People getting ready for King v. Burwell. Yes, Pat Robertson. I have a theory about this net neutrality that I'm going to talk to Cliff about. We shall see. Also, the GOP chair of the House Science Committee has told folks he didn't vaccinate his kids. He doesn't have to because they're healthy. Showing a perfect display of total ignorance when it comes to science. All that and more on today's program. Want to start out with this story, which is really bizarre. Apparently yesterday, Missouri State Auditor Tom Schweich, I'm not sure how to pronounce his name, killed himself in what is an apparent suicide. Shot himself in the head. Schweich was considered a leading candidate to run for governor. I don't know that many people thought that he would win. But yesterday afternoon, the editorial page editor of the St. Louis Post-Dispatch, a guy named Tony Messenger, wrote, I guess it was like an opinion piece, but he wrote about the death of this guy, the suicide of Tom Schweich, who apparently he had a fairly close relationship. It seems like it was a professional relationship, but a close one, or closer than most politicians have with reporters. Let's put it that way. They would meet once or twice a month for lunch, et cetera, et cetera. And Messenger wrote a column about Schweich saying that he wasn't a very good politician because he would buck a lot of people in his own party, and also sometimes just seemed to have not a real good political sense, even in interpersonal relations. But he goes on to write, "I have no idea why Schweitz killed himself. But for the past several days, he had been confiding in me that he planned to accuse the chairman of the Missouri Republican Party, John Hancock, with leading a whisper campaign among donors that he, Schweitz, was Jewish." And Messenger goes on to say he wasn't, which is to say that he attended an Episcopal church, but that doesn't mean that he wasn't proud of his Jewish heritage passed down from his grandfather. Which, of course, you know, that part of the story is really sort of irrelevant, whether or not the guy was or wasn't. The point of a whisper campaign is that you're supposedly exposing something is really damaging. Now, Messenger goes on to write that Missouri is the state that gave us Fraser Glenn Miller, the raging racist who last year killed three people at a Jewish community center in Kansas City. It's the state on which the day before Schweitz died, the Anti-Defamation League reported on a rise of white supremacist prison gangs in the state. I don't think prison gangs can vote. I mean, so when the head of the Republican Party is allegedly starting a whisper campaign that this guy running for governor may be Jewish, I mean, it's just, I don't know. It's a bizarre story, but it also gives you a sense of, like, if they're doing whisper campaigns that a guy might be Jewish or might have Jewish ancestry, can you just imagine how full-throated their full-on racism is? I mean, honestly, this guy might be Jewish. Well, at least he ain't no nig. I mean, that's what's going on there, I would imagine. But that's stunning. That's it'll be interesting to see if they dig into that story.
I look forward to Fox News when it comes out that this was an anti-Semitic murder to be like, you know, we should not have to answer for this. What was the last time a Democratic leader had to disavow Al Sharpton?
Right. Or this just goes to show how important it is for Democrats to show up and listen to what Bibi Netanyahu has to say.
Exactly. I think Democrats skipping this speech gave the space for the Missouri Republican Party chairman.
That is the problem. They don't seem to appreciate anti-Semitism. And Bibi is the leader of the Jews. All right. We're going to take a break and go talk to Cliff Schechter. Oh, but a reminder, folks. A little bit of house cleaning. Next week, I am going to be I'll be live every day, but I'm going to be down in Washington on Tuesday and Wednesday covering the King versus Burwell case from next door from the Supreme Court. So be sure to tune in for that. Should be interesting stuff. I'll get some pre-taped stuff. I'll have some live interviews, hopefully. And also, a couple other things to note. On Monday, if we are lucky enough on Sunday night to have been nominated for a podcast award, and, of course, the nominations are closed, on Monday we'll start the voting. Now, in years past, you've been able to vote every day, once a day. And so we're going to need your help in the event that we get nominated. No guarantee that we were. Hopefully we will. Monday we'll also, hopefully, launch the Indiegogo campaign. We got a really thoughtful email from a listener saying, you should maybe think about doing Kickstarter, because it has more people could see it theoretically on Kickstarter. I'm not as convinced by that, but there were some other very good ideas in there. So it's probably going to be an Indiegogo campaign. We will more than likely start that on Monday. Also remind you that you can support this show by becoming a member at jointhemajorityreport.com. Or if you buy crap from Amazon, buy it through our link at majorityreportkickback.com. Very easy to do. And, of course, justcoffee.coop, fair trade coffee, tea, or chocolate. Use the coupon code MAJORITY. Get 10% off. It's great coffee. All right, we're going to take a break when we come back. Cliff Schechter. and gentlemen. We are back. Sam Cedar on the Majority Report. What did Leonard Nimoy die? Yeah. Oh, my gosh. All right. Well, we'll talk about that in a second. Let's just first get this theme song going.
Cliff Schachter, Libertas LLC, New Media, Public Relations, and Strategy. You want any of these services, you know who you gotta see. Cliff Schachter, Libertas LLC.
Yes, ladies and gentlemen, it is the great Cliff Schachter joining us as he does virtually every Friday, and thankfully so. Hello, Cliff.
Sammy, how the hell are you?
Sorry to start with that sad news about Leonard Nimoy.
That's really sad. I'm sorry. Awesome dude, what those guys contributed to culture in terms of telling, I mean, seriously, man, I still think Star Trek is probably one of the most important TV shows of all time, just for what it told us in the late 60s was a future we could have with things looking very different. And can you imagine watching that in the late 60s, you know, and seeing what are the first of the first interracial kiss on TV and all these things in the kind of society we were living in then? I mean, ugh, that's sad. He was a pathbreaker, you know?
Yeah, well, I mean, he did... He did live long and was prosperous, and so, I mean, I say that out of respect. Obviously, I'm a huge Leonard Nimoy fan. He died, I guess, he was about 83 or 84. A guy was born in Boston, if I remember correctly. He got that little symbol from being raised as an Orthodox Jew, which I guess is, when you are, I think, dealing with candles, you do that type of thing. But, yeah, I agree with you. I mean, you think about the TV show, still is an effective franchise. But you know, I can't help but think, like, if that show came out today, there would be this sort of like backlash from the right on some level. I can't help but think.
Oh that. My God! In today's media environment, yeah. I mean, because if you to do something equivalent to that, what they were doing. I mean, remember, there are places at that point in time who were fighting just letting African-Americans and whites go to school together.
Right.
Right. Appear in the same buildings, much less kissing each other
right.
in public. I mean, that kind of stuff. Right. Showing an African-American woman in a position of, I mean, not quite equality because it wasn't like she was like, you know, the captain or stuff that they did later on. But still, as a sort of an executive group, so to speak, on a ship. You know, on a starship, that she could be in that kind of a position, have risen to that position. I mean, it was sort of against the worldview, and my guess is against what majorities of people in polling probably thought at that period in time. So, I mean, take whatever you think would be one of the most far-reaching things today and imagine doing that, you know, something that was years away. I mean, I think that makes a lot of what change that's happened possible. Cultural change, again, I know it's like a broken record on this, but always comes before political change.
Yeah,
and
indeed.
That was... far-reaching.
All right. Well, let's talk about some of the stuff that's happened this week in terms of the news. Let's start with what is happening with the Department of Homeland Security funding. Now, it's an interesting. I every day, and you know, I don't talk about it every day, but I am just. It is just stunning to see how ineffectual the Republicans seem to be, and look, I obviously anticipated that they wouldn't be terribly good at promoting an agenda, but they're not just not only not doing anything legislatively, they can't even seem to maintain any type of narrative. They just seem to be completely adrift. They set this deadline for today, an arbitrary deadline, of when the funding for Department of Homeland Security was going to run out so that they could protest President Obama's deferred action on immigration executive orders. And they can't pass a bill. I don't even know. They're going to try right now to punt for 3 weeks. And I don't even know if they can pass the bill to punt for 3 weeks. We're waiting to see if they can pass that right now.
Yeah. Yeah, no, I mean, they, I mean, you know, I think we kind of predicted this, and there's still something different. I think that's some of what you're saying here. I mean, none of us expected them to really govern.
Right.
There's something different about really experiencing in real time, you know, what just a fractured group of goofballs they are. That, you know, when you encourage your own party to run on such a platform of, you know, complete individual autonomy, I don't know if that's the right word, but, you know, basically not giving a crap about anybody but yourself, because that's the highest form of being an American in our country, according to them. You know, not good for team building, Sam. And they all realize that that's their path to glory, because at this point, you know, we've discussed this before too. You know, I mean, at this point, running for office is as much about, you know, getting your brand out there and building name recognition for a career on Fox News or talk radio or going around giving corporate speeches as it is anything else. It's a means to an end at this point. It's not just an end. So, I mean, these guys, you basically have a lot, you know, nobody, they're there because they came there because we need to make these changes together. I mean, even the people that were swept in with Reagan, as conservative as they were, they had an agenda. They had a thing, things uniting them that they wanted to change. What the hell do these guys want to do? Do anybody actually really say what, I guess they want to outlaw being gay, or certainly being gay and married. They want to outlaw abortion. I guess there's a couple things that the vast majority of them want to do together, but mostly when it comes to sort of actually sort of forward governing and reforming things, I mean, is there really any agenda? No. So it's just sort of the default is, how do I get myself on the Sunday shows? You know, how do I make sure I get to go on Fox and Friends tomorrow morning?
The amazing thing is, though, is that it's not just that they're not doing anything. It's that they don't even – they haven't been able to figure out, which I think in the past they've been good at, is they're not effective at even they seemingly pushing for anything. Like, they're all of their – you know, I mean, and I want to talk about this – and this sort of dovetails with the net neutrality thing too, which I find just sort of stunning. I mean – The Keystone XL thing went past with a whimper, right? I mean, think about this. President Obama vetoed that bill this week, and it was just a bill that would have allowed Congress to do it. And if you had asked me when he vetoes this 4 or 5 months ago, I would have said, well, when he vetoes it, if he does veto it, it is going to be all about, they're going to trumpet how this is just about what is in the purview of the president and what is in the purview of Congress, that it was completely
right.
a process style veto. The administration didn't even have to push that because nobody cares. Like there's no constituency out there that, at least in the public, that cares about the fact that he stopped Congress from permitting Keystone XL. And I think, you know, the idea of the administration not permitting Keystone at this point is just like, yeah, that may make the news for half a day, even though this
right.
has been like the primary centerpiece of the Republican Party for the past 6 months.
And yeah, exactly. And it's like in and out, gone, because since day one, when they got into office, they have just made such a freaking mess of the entire place.
Well,
from
but
what
it's
they've
also
chosen to prioritize, to the backbiting, to their secret histories of white supremacy fandom among their leadership. To, I mean, it's literally they can't stop stepping on their own. I don't know. Can I say that on radio? Maybe not.
The other aspect about this is that when you contemplate, like, you know, the reaction to that. You contemplate the reaction to the to now we're seeing what happened with their reaction. I mean, this is their big reaction. People should remember what's going on with this Department of Homeland Security thing, which people are barely making a blip, is the pushback to President Obama providing the DACA. Expanded DACA, essentially, the deferred action on deportation
right.
for 5 million people. That was supposedly, if he had done this, I mean, people have to remember what the rhetoric was 6 months, 8 months ago from the Republican Party. If he does this, he is going to create a constitutional crisis. They can't mount anything off this now. And
no.
And my, you know, what I'm thinking is that I wonder if there are, I'm hoping that there are activist groups. I mean, like, this is now sort of part of the historical record. This is what happens when you take these what were perceived as dangerous political positions, when you take these positions and you do it unabashedly, nothing. There's no pushback.
Right. Well, I mean, when you take sort of these outlandish positions like they do, when you kind of step way out there and throw around the kind of rhetoric they throw around, then, you know, it's pretty damn hard to walk that stuff back. The amazing thing is you find that the people out there who rely on you and believe in you actually expect you to do what you were saying. It's a joke. I mean, they passed, this morning? They passed with almost 70 votes the Homeland Security funding through September in the Senate, you know?
Right.
Which is something they said they wouldn't do, but they just did. And then there's the Boehner clown show of what he can get people together for. It's the House, where it's even worse than, you know, because in the Senate, at least, as well as among those currently running for president, I don't know if there are any House members among those. I don't think there are. There's at least a vague notion that you have to try to appeal to Hispanic people. In most of these districts, you know, in most of these gerrymandered Republican districts, you know, there's maybe like 8 non-white people there.
Right.
So they just haven't. Winning the Senate, you actually need to win Hispanic voters. You may not in a given year, like, you know, the last time around when they won in 14 because of the way the map was set up, but you will eventually. Because there's enough states out there where you must appeal to minority voters, appeal to women. And for the presidential race, you have to. But these guys in the House, you know, so they really, by everything they've done from, you know, I mean, we've talked about this before, but from building this sort of, you know, right-wing outrage complex of media properties and think tanks and whatever, they've screwed themselves and doomed themselves to not being able to govern. You know, and they've done the same thing in the way they've gerrymandered their House seats. You know, so I mean, I don't know what the hell they're going to do, but I mean, I don't know how they can govern any of this, and they just keep sort of spitting in, you know, the eye of a growing population of people in this country who are going to continue to grow beyond them when you count all minorities eventually, not that far off into the future. I mean, I'm not sure what they think they can do here, but they've put themselves in this position, and they deserve everything they get.
Yeah, well, and what's fascinating about it to me is that you have this situation where in the Senate they have this pressure that they feel like we've got to make it look like we're doing some things because, of course, when they run for re-election, it's a broader populace, you know, as opposed to the House, like the point you've just made. But on the House side, the leadership cannot fully embrace what the vast majority, or at the very least, a huge portion of their caucus embraces in terms of a narrative, which that caucus sort of lives on its own reservoir, like you say, because, you know, they go on WorldNet daily television, they'll go on
right.
Fox, they'll go on, I mean, there's a whole sort of just like a growing world of right wing media.
It's almost organic at this point.
But
a growing world of crazy because there's so much money to be made.
Yes.
You know, so that you even have like the Breitbart idiots and Chuck Johnson. I mean, all these goofballs who see that there's money out there because, again, it's the essential connection made here. And others have done it, but certainly Rick Perlstein has done it one of the best of connecting conservatism to just all the, you know, the kind of conservatism they sell, at least, to all the other cons that they sell their lists, you know, their email lists online about, you know, penis pills and, you know, balding chores and all these kinds of things. Well, this is just another thing.
But what's fascinating about it
to send their money to.
What's fascinating about it now, as opposed to, let's say, 10 years ago, is that what's going on in that world is not infecting the mainstream media the way it did 10 years ago. So in some ways, like a guy like Boehner, who is trying to seem reasonable to the country, is not echoing what's coming out, what's growing in this sort of like in these fever swamps. And
no, that's exactly right. Because when you start seeing, I can give perfect examples here, many of them. I won't go into all the details, but, you know, I live in a state in Ohio that's a key swing state. It's basically a 50-50 state. We've got 5 more Republican congressmen/women than we should have. Because of the crazy redistricting. They're mostly from rural districts, the way they set up. They're crazy people. Jim Jordan is one of them. He's from North Central Ohio, and he's an example of somebody who is one of those guys in, like, the Republican study group or whatever the right-wing group is that broke away from that because it wasn't right-wing enough.
Right.
I mean, just a lunatic. And there's others like that in there. And even the media properties here, because the three biggest newspapers in the state, I would call the Cleveland Plain Dealer kind of center of the road. I'd call the Dispatch, Columbus Dispatch, center right. And the Inquirer here in Cincinnati is very conservative. But you find them now even breaking with Republicans on numerous things, on numerous issues, whether it's trying to shut down all these clinics, or whether it's on gun issues, or whether it's on gay rights issues, whether it's on climate change. You can go on and down the list, even economic issues, which I thought some of these guys would never break with them on. But they've gotten so crazy. So even sort of their representatives in mainstream media, what used to be, you're exactly right. They're like, what the hell is going on here?
And the amazing thing is, it's not going to impact those Republicans. I mean, that's the thing. Is they're breaking with them, but it's not going to impact them because, again, they have their own sort of reservoir of, like, you know, crazy juice that keeps them going in the form of these in these feeders.
Their people are not, you know, yeah, you're right. I mean, their people may casually read the Cincinnati Inquirer, but they're watching Fox all day.
Yep.
They're getting emails from the National Right to Life Committee, you know, telling them that the world's about to blow up. You know, I mean, you know, they're watching Brent Bozell videos on Benghazi. I mean, you know, this is what their base is doing. They're not even reading conservative mainstream media anymore. And you're right. And they don't have to react to it because most of their districts, outside of maybe, you know, a dozen, two dozen yep. districts that are swing districts, are a joke.
Yep. And so, I mean, we have like this is a different paradigm, is the point that I think I'm trying to make here to people that we've had than we've had over the past, I think, decade or so. I mean, because, you know, and who's in power, of course, changes, you know, in the House or in the Senate or in the presidency changes the dynamic. But it has gone along a fairly structured the physics of it were more or less the same. One is up, one is down. But the physics still work the same way. The physics don't work the same way now. We're seeing something
that's
that is fundamentally different, I think, because of there's this sub-Republican party that doesn't need to be mainstream anymore in any shape or
– it benefits from not being mainstream because it can be more populist and run against the mainstream. That leads certain candidates in most of these districts that they've created. It creates a better opportunity for them to get elected. It creates an opportunity for people to make more money. I mean, Fox is the best example. If ever there was a sort of station because of the appeal Fox could have that you'd think would want to sort of delve in mainstream, it would be Fox. But even Fox, because they realize who they're appealing to here, they're not appealing to center-right readers. I mean, that's a nice extra, you know, group to get. But their most fervent, you know, people who are going to watch that damn station 24/7, you know, and are the lunatics who are buying gold and you know, gathering in the basement for the coming apocalypse.
And I mean, don't care about just how impeached everything apparently Bill O'Reilly says. I mean, this is let's segue to
good
this.
Segue,
because,
my man.
Well, but no, but I think like this is a good metaphor because the people who watch Bill O'Reilly do not care that he seems to be a serial liar. And I'm not talking about, you know, Sam Cedar saying he's a serial liar on, you know, on policy or the policy implications or there's weapons of mass destruction in Iraq. I mean, just sort of like apparently this guy cannot tell an anecdote without and this latest one is really, you know, there was the story about how apparently he claimed in his book that he was knocking on the door of a
I know that story well. Mulrun Deschult, I can't pronounce his name very well, but the JFK assassination buff of sorts. You know, it was one of the people they were who was going to testify between the on the select committee on assassinations. And he killed himself, shot himself with a shotgun. It's always have been, by the way, suspicions around that, but we won't get into it. And O'Reilly claims he was right outside the guy's door. When he
like,
wasn't anywhere,
literally.
The guy's in Florida. O'Reilly's in Dallas. I mean, he wasn't in the same city.
Right. These are not lies like, you know, I would claim, like, he's lying about the implications of net neutrality. This is just sheer, like, oh, yeah, I Yeah, I used to be a race car driver.
And, yeah, you know, that's like, the ticket. Like, you start saying that's the ticket at the end of everything.
Exactly.
Maybe.
I mean, this is like literally, you know, I think when I was in second grade or first grade, I told people that Speed Racer was my brother. And the reason why you never saw him is because he's at college. I mean, these are the type of
lies. That's not true.
No, that turns out. I'm sorry. I was supposed to correct that. But here is the latest one. Where
the LA riots one, please tell the one because it's so awesome.
This is unbelievable. So Bill O'Reilly claims that he was caught with his fellow, I guess, reporters and, you know, his production team.
Right.
Yeah, he was he claims that he was caught in the middle of the riots where he concrete was raining down on us, and we
were attacked. That's the important phrase there, raining down on us.
Yes.
You have to imagine enormous piles of concrete coming in, bricks coming down on their heads, is what he was saying.
We were attacked by protesters. Well, apparently, the Guardian spoke to a bunch of members of that team, and they said, oh, no, that's not what happened at all. This is the way that one of them describes. There were people putting out fires nearby, and Bill O'Reilly showed up in his fancy car. Apparently, he took a limo.
He showed up in a freaking limo.
And so the driver of O'Reilly's
got out and started polishing the car as the place was on fire. I mean, not the place, as in, like, around them. Buildings are on fire, and there's riots, and this guy gets out and starts polishing the car.
Now, one guy, McCowan, or Teresa McCowan, I guess, who was one of the people on the production team, says there was no concrete. There was a single brick. And not only was there a single brick, it was a guy who was watching O'Reilly set up his camera shoot. And according to McCowan, Bill was being Bill, complaining, people are in my eye line, and being very insensitive to the situation. It was just so out of line. He starts barking commands about, this isn't good enough for me. This isn't going to work. Who's in charge here? And so the man shouted abuse at O'Reilly and the team, crew members said, and O'Reilly ordered him to shut up. And he asked, don't you know
who I am? You can't imagine any of that happening, by the way, right?
Impossible.
I've never heard the man tell somebody to shut up. I've never heard him, we're doing live, you know, that kind of thing.
And he yells, don't you know who I am? And so the guy came and took a brick and smashed the camera. Didn't threaten anybody, didn't throw it at anybody, smashed the camera. And so it was interesting. One of the guys...
The concrete, just to be clear, rained down from his hand into the back of the camera.
Right, indeed. And and then apparently O'Reilly pretended that he was going to go after the guy. And one of the producers, who was like a foot shorter than O'Reilly, held him back. And he said it wasn't very hard. Bill was sort of not really actually going to. The producer.
Yeah, O'Reilly supposedly was like ashen. He was like white, like pale white, scared out of his mind, but trying to act tough. I mean, that's why I love this one even better than all the other ones. Everything in here, from the lie about what happened, like on the other cases, you know, just a complete exaggeration of anything that occurred. But beyond that, he shows up in a limo, has his driver polish it. That's what gets the guy angry, not that the guy wants to. Not that it's a riot and the guy wants to attack any reporters there, but because of what a jerk he's being. He's yelling at him to shut up, another classic O'Reilly move. Telling him who he is, another classic O'Reilly move, which, by the way, at that time, he's the host of Inside Edition, which I'm sure everybody knew who that host was.
Yeah, don't you know who I am?
Exactly. This is exactly the way I've pictured that this man lives every day of his life.
Yeah.
I mean,
this is
going
the best
around
line.
Showing off while having this enormous chip on his shoulder and never feeling good enough for the establishment, which is why he needs to always scream against it and say how reporters are so liberal and so terrible, because all these reporters who thought Bill O'Reilly sucked at his job because he sucked at his job must be just liberal plants, you know, who hate me. He's going around in a limo to try to impress people. He's telling people, do you know who I am? He's threatening to fight like he always does on his show, even though he's such a wimp, he never would have done a damn thing. I mean, this is like literally If you want, like, the angry, white, resentful male in the Republican Party, all of their various personality quirks, it's all there in Bill O'Reilly in this incident.
And
all of it.
Now, to be fair, there was some disagreement amongst members of the team as to whether or not O'Reilly was actually responsible for the guy's behavior. Okay, so one person, McCowan, said, well, I mean, it would have pissed me off. There didn't seem to be a sensitivity for what these people were going through. It was more, I'm here to do my show. Another guy said O'Reilly had provoked the man, who was pissed off with O'Reilly's attitude. A third, however, rejected suggestions that O'Reilly was responsible. Not at all, he said. Another guy said he didn't know. I can't say if that's true or not, he said, but, quote, I don't have much respect for Bill, having worked for him during that time. He was a real jackass. Which is like, I'm still a news guy. I'm not going to make an assessment that I can't verify. But I will say this with assuredness. He was a total jackass. I mean, you got to appreciate the integrity involved in that statement. But here's the getting. The broader point is that Bill O'Reilly will not lose his job.
Nope.
And the question is, will the metaphor hold? In other words, will those people who have said, look, Fox News is a news outlet? Because, look, NBC fires, essentially. I mean, it's a six-month suspension, but we all know the guy's not coming back. Brian Williams, for doing this exact thing, maybe to a lesser degree. Maybe there's more stuff we don't know. But at this point, I would imagine there would be reporters out there looking for it. NBC basically fires this guy because, even though they're not a full-time news station, just because this guy is anchoring their news show and he has to have credibility. Okay, now, putting aside the arguments of, like, the problems with the media anyways, at least that is the game, the way the game is played. For us to maintain our credibility as a news organization, we need to get rid of this guy because he's fabricated stories about himself. When Fox does not do that, they will, pay a price with the millions that watch them. If anything, I bet you his ratings go up.
They have.
B, the question is, will the rest of the media, in the way that, the sort of Republican base is now sort of put aside and essentially you live in your own little universe, you will control this territory, be it House seats or, you know, whatever, 2.5 million people watching every night. You'll control this territory, but we're just not going to allow you to infect us anymore. The question is, will the rest of the media finally say what many of us have been saying, is that they're not a news organization. That you
never have been. News is sort of a.
These are not your colleagues. You know, like, right. You now have to say, like, they're entertainment. Like, it doesn't even make sense to compare the ratings of, say, MSNBC and Fox, because that would be like comparing the ratings of MSNBC with TNT.
Right. You know, I mean, what is that there is, I mean, it's, and I'm glad you're saying that, because that's exactly it here. Because when I started seeing some friends, you know, on the left, who were like, you know, we got to push this and get him fired. And, you know, and in nice and a respectful way, I just sort of said, you know, you can't. I mean, there's the point of Brian Williams, whose job was dependent upon him still having credibility as an objective arbiter of the news, that was lost when he lied. With what O'Reilly's done, O'Reilly gets people to watch him not for that reason, but because he's the biggest jackass in the room, because he is a bully, because he does insult people on the left constantly and say that everything's a left-wing conspiracy against him and all of that, and it sells because they're looking for a very small sliver, it's cable, of the audience that is passionate, you know, and even a couple million people in this country is not a huge number of people, but that doesn't matter. That's all they need to get to be a top-rated cable show, or at least cable news show. And they throw reporters. I'm not saying there aren't any real reporters there. I've actually often thought that Shepard Smith can do a pretty good job. But the reporters who are in there, and he's, by the way, the only one that was there before Roger Iles got there, which is important to say. But even if there's others like him, there are a few others, they're there to give it the appearance of it being a news station. There are reporters there who are part of the camouflage. But overall, it's a right-wing propaganda station, which nobody so much as Roger Iles himself 20 years earlier than they created it or more, said he wanted to create something like that called, I think it was Right Wing News, or I don't remember what the hell they were calling it back then. When Nixon was being attacked, he saw that Nixon couldn't be defended because they didn't have outlets that could start questioning truth and make it a he said, she said thing, which is exactly what they would have done with Watergate, and Nixon probably never would have had to leave. And so that was their goal, was to create a sort of, you know, this kind of ecosystem where they could respond and there was no actual truth. And Fox has done that very successfully when it comes to, you know, their corporate guys who need that from them, you know, Exxon and others when it comes to climate change, their religious zealot supporters when it comes to evolution and things like that. And they've been able to do that, but they've done that very much with the news itself there. And that being that Roger Iles comes from the exact same background, you know, as O'Reilly, which, by the way, is the exact same background as another star of the past 2 weeks, Rudy Giuliani, which are sort of these angry sort of working class white guys, you know, at least they came from that background. They're all rich as hell now, who resent everything, blame everyone for their own problems, and then somewhere along the way realize that the same sort of notions they have about the way the world works, the same resentments they have, all the people who are watching them and who are fans of them have. And they've created an entire media property, and in Giuliani's case, you know, his own sort of profile around attracting people to this exact phenomenon that they know works because it works in their own minds. And so it doesn't matter. I mean, all O'Reilly can do is gain an audience with this. I mean, it's gone up right now. Now, granted, whenever there's controversy, you know, numbers go up. My guess is they'll come back down close to his normal numbers, but they're not going to go below his normal numbers because none of the people who love him and watch him have ever watched him to get the truth. So what the hell would change now? And Roger Iles has never wanted the truth, so why would he care? I mean, you know, the Fox News Network itself has always behaved like a political campaign. They've never been embarrassed by their actions or whatever. They have a PR organization there within Fox that's like any PR unit within a political campaign. Anybody questions them, they attack them and call them names. They don't apologize.
The real question is going to be, and I don't know where we will have an example of like of how this – I don't know where we'll have an opportunity for this to manifest it. But, I mean, recall in the early days of the Obama administration, in the press pool, I think Fox was either not given a seat or put in the way back or something.
Right.
And other media outlets complained, like, hey, this is not right. We have to stick up for our fellow journalists. Well, I mean, I think, like, you know, I don't know when the next opportunity for them to do this will be, but it'll be telling at that point as to whether or not really, I mean, can you really defend this outlet as a fellow journalistic enterprise if they won't even play that game about we don't have an anchor who's going to lie about the time that he was shot at or got concrete hailed on him or whatever the, you know what I mean? Like that's really going to be the question.
Now, and then you need to go beyond that too. And I think Rachel Maddow, I saw a segment, she touched a little bit on this, but this is such an important part of it too, is not just is it not a news outlet and supporting a guy who clearly now on we've got four different occasions from nuns in Ecuador, you know, was it Ecuador? No, El Salvador, pardon me, to you know, what happened now, we're talking about Los Angeles, to what happened in the Falklands and what happened with the JFK, the suicide or so-called suicide of this man who knew some stuff about the assassination, apparently. Well, we've got these four different episodes where this guy has done this, and so we know that part of the equation, but the second part is how Fox has reacted to this and how O'Reilly's reacted, which is not only to call David Corn names and say he's a liar and he's a gutter snipe and the kinds of things that, you know, most people don't think it's appropriate for people calling themselves reporters of any sort to be engaging in with other reporters, but how he's literally used violent language of the sort you'd expect to come from Sarah Palin of the Tea Party in saying that we're going to put, he's like, I want to see David Corn put in the kill zone. I mean, what the hell does that say to every lunatic out there watching Fox? He's refused to apologize for that. Fox has refused to apologize for that. And he also threatened a female reporter in his usual sexist Andrea Macris kind of way he treats women, you know, telling her that he was going to come after her. I mean, real news stations can't behave like that or they're not real news stations. It's pretty simple.
Indeed.
And so in that way, too, I've just never understood. I get it why some Democrats have felt they need to go on there because it's a big audience and defend things that are sort of, you know, that they take and they completely sort of put it in one end. It comes out of the other. It looks nothing like what anybody on the left had actually said, the way they smear people and everything. But the one thing I have never understood is why the Obama administration has ever felt a need to give them an ounce of credibility. I don't know why they've ever called on one of their people in a press conference. I don't know why he did that interview before the Super Bowl or whatever it was a few years ago with O'Reilly, why they've ever sent him or Biden on any Fox property. I mean, as far as I'm concerned, if they were increasing the danger of my daily job by telling people that I wasn't a real American, that I was coming for their guns, and all the other things they've said to probably, you know, incite riot almost against the president of the United States, to pander to their racist base, to do everything else, I've never understood why the Obama people didn't just say, you know what, as long as you carry that stuff on, you can be conservatives, you can criticize my policies, but as long as you carry that kind of stuff on, I will not appear on your network. Nobody from my administration will appear on your network. We will not answer your questions. We will have absolutely nothing to do with you. I've never understood why he wouldn't do that, why they wouldn't do that. They gain nothing from his conversations with them and from giving them what they want, which is even the slightest form of access.
Indeed. Well, Cliff, I wanted to get into Scott Walker with you, but I'm afraid we're out of time. Scott Walker had a fascinating quote that I think sort of reveals both
ISIS and unions.
Yeah, you know what? Let's do it.
Matthew, that may be the only question he's answered so far.
Matthew, Sam. Film guy, I know is listening, and so hang in there, Matthew, film guy. We will get there. All right. So here is audio of Scott Walker at CPAC making the case that he has the foreign policy bona fides, the commander-in-chief bona fides, to lead this country in the face of this made-up existential threat from ISIS. Here is Scott Walker.
I want a commander-in-chief who will do everything in their power to ensure that the threat from radical Islamic terrorists do not wash up on American soil. We will have someone who leads and ultimately will send a message not only that we will protect American soil, but do not take this upon freedom-loving people anywhere else in the world. We need a leader with that kind of confidence. If I can take on 100,000 protesters, I can do the same across the world.
Yes, 100,000 people advocating for higher wages are very similar to ISIS.
I mean, you know, it's interesting because there's really two ways that he can be attacked for this. And you'll see him being attacked on the right in one way and on the left on the other. And I can guess where Hillary Clinton, in the event that she faces him in the general or whoever the Democratic candidate is. But I have a feeling, sadly, it would be more from the right. But the attack from the right, of course, is just, you don't understand the threat. You have diminished the superpowers.
Rick Perry's already gone for that one.
Okay, the superpowers of ISIS, to compare them to mere mortals or Americans or protesters, you are doing a disservice to our vision of just how dangerous existentially terrorism is. And then, of course, from the left, and I think, you know, in some respects, both critiques are right, is this is how this guy looks upon citizens who are doing
things,
welders, sanitation workers, teachers. I mean, I was there, and it wasn't like these hordes were we had to batten down the hatches. We had to have gun turrets on the top of the
you have to
Capitol.
Be very careful when the 75-year-old teacher comes at you with that ruler to try to behead you.
Exactly, like they were carrying signs, man.
I know. Did you see the signs?
There was a drum circle.
Go ahead.
There was a drum circle, for God's sakes.
Somebody made a statement saying he's actually starting to seem rather like Sarah Palin, which I thought was interesting, because I think that's not so far off.
Now, here is the question.
They both have no grasp of, of policy. They both get along, you know, very popular, or at least she was when she was in politics, among, you know, their own party, particularly their base. They're very good at that kind of stuff. They're very bad at having any understanding of policy, being able to answer any questions. They both have very, let's call it, checkered educational backgrounds and ethical backgrounds. Not so far off.
Yeah, I mean, I think he's going to be a much better candidate than she was, frankly. I mean, remember, she didn't have to get through the primaries. I mean, she was just basically catapulted onto the national stage.
No, that's true.
I think he's better. But here's the question. Does this guy pay a price for these type of things? If, you know, I think there's going to be more of these. But when he says something like that, is he going to pay a price in the Republican primary? I think in the general, he will pay a price and he'll have to walk it back. But it seems to me the only thing that they didn't, you know, there's two different ways you walk this back, right? You come back with a clarifying statement or where you articulated it so that it gets on the news, or you have your press person send out a statement that says he was just making the point that leadership is important in the face of adversity, which is what they did, which indicates to me that they still think there's a benefit to have this out there comparing, union protests to terrorists.
Yeah, I mean, I don't know. You're right. I don't know if he pays a price in a Republican primary. In a general election, again, for good or ill, and it can often be for ill, you know, because you think of sort of Maureen Dowd columns and things like that, not to mention other, aspects of it. But you know, kind of elite media can really determine whether somebody's credible or not. And if the guy keeps sitting there and saying either stupid things like that when he opens his mouth or refusing to open his mouth on things like evolution or virtually anything else, did he answer any questions before that? He just starts looking kind of like an idiot and kind of like he thinks he doesn't have to take part in the process. And that'll start pissing people in the media off. And then I think in a general election, it does hurt him, you know?
Yep.
So I do think that, and I think the more radical positions might make some people say, really? That you thought that was worthy of a comparison? So, yeah, I do. In a primary, live in that crazy bubble. I mean, what can hurt you in a Republican primary these days, I think short of coming out for some liberal policy, almost nothing can hurt you.
Helps them. All right, Cliff Schechter, I appreciate, as always, your being here. We'll talk to you again next Friday.
Thanks a lot, Sammy. Take care, bud.
Bye-bye. All right, folks. Bing, boom. Yeah, we're going to go late today. We're going to get a freebie Friday.
You want to play the Jimmy Reefer Cake song in between?
Oh, yeah. We're going to play the Jimmy Reefer Cake song. We're going to take a break. We'll play the Jimmy Reefer Cake song. I will respond to it when we get back, and then we will also have film guy Matthew on the phone. We'll be right back after the – what is the Jimmy Reefer Cake song?
It's called It's Cold.
You know what? It has been cold. And I have to say that – back in the day when I would go out to L.A., you know, for a week here or there, you know, I'm talking 10 years ago, 15 years ago now, I guess as late as like 10 years ago, I would spend a month or so in L.A. or I would spend a week, do some auditioning and then come back invariably for the pilot that I was going to do. That's the way I rolled back then. I would find that it was nice. You get a week sometime in February and it makes the rest of the winter feel easy. This time around, I think it hurt because I realized, like, oh my God, this winter is long and it's cold and I'm done with it. So let's, very apropos, let's hear the song.
Negative 15 this friggin' morning. I loaded up the friggin' pellets, turned the brassy up to high because it's cold. Yeah, it's cold. And I hope you're staying warm. The plastic on my porch is torn. I'm plowing and my back is sore. Saying hammer down, bub, and give it the corn. It's colder than a polar bear's touch hole. It's colder than a penguin's tit. So cold that my old man moved to Florida. Said I friggin' had enough of it. I hope you're staying warm. Gotta fix that crack in my door. I'm plowing and my back is sore. Saying, hammer down, bub. Give it the corn, 'cause it's cold.
All right. I like it. It is. It is incredibly cold. They've been getting a lot of snow up in Maine. I know because my folks live in Worcester, Massachusetts, in the middle of the snow belt, and it goes right up through Worcester up into Maine more often than not. Worcester, I think, the snowiest city in the country this year. The snowiest city in the country. The pictures are crazy. And I'll tell you, today, the first time I ever felt like, you know what? If it's like this next year, if we get two of these in a row, I'm going to, like, I don't know where. I don't know where I would end up going. I don't think I would go to California. I think, like, Asheville, North Carolina or something.
Asheville, North Carolina? What's in Asheville?
It's just I've heard it's a, you know, fairly liberal area, and it's supposed to be very nice. So... And it's warm. It's warmer than here, would be my guess. All right, folks. Now, as you know, it is Friday. And on Fridays, I traditionally have on either I have somebody on to not talk about politics, but to talk about what film I can watch over the weekend streaming. And who better to do that, particularly on the week, the first Friday back from my triumphant return from the West Coast doing Marin's IFC show, than film guy Matthew? And what better way to bring him on than his own custom film guy Matthew theme song? I gotta say, ever since I went to the sort of when we moved to the studio and I went to the dual headphones, I've appreciated that song a lot more, I have to say. Matthew, film guy, so apropos to have you the week after I've come back from doing Marin Show and the week after the Oscars.
Hello, Sam. Glad to be here. Glad you survived your week out there in California.
Now, I want to talk to you about both those things, the Oscars and you know, my time with Marin. Let's briefly do the Oscars thing because...
But, Sam, I'm still really broken up. You broke the news to me about Leonard Nimoy, and I have not been this upset about a celebrity death, I think, since Bill Bixby died, in terms of what they meant to my childhood. So I'm not sure how good I'll be in this segment because I'm really... off my center right now.
You're not being facetious. I know this about you.
No. Star Trek has been the crucial aspect of my cultural media upbringing, and Spock was like a second father to me. I had like a bank my father bought me, and before I was born, it's like the one thing I've kept since those days. And I just, you know, Star Trek, I'm a huge fan. You know, I know a lot of people know me as a highfalutin art film guy, but my roots are in sci-fi and Star Trek, so I'm really affected by this, so it's a sad one for me, Sam.
But at least he was, you know, in his early 80s, right? Least he's not, you know, it's not, you know,
yeah, but,
the guys
you know, now
in
we've
his 50s
lost, we've lost Spock, we've lost Bones, and we've lost Scotty. So it's getting hard to watch Star Trek without feeling a little bit upset, you know. It's times like this that I wish I had finished the Kolinar ritual and purged myself of all emotions.
Well, did you, I'm sorry, you wish you finished the Kolinar ritual?
Yes, I started it, and then I was called back to my duty aboard the Starship Enterprise, so I could not complete it.
Yeah, but, all right. We're just, we've got a large ship that's passing through our studio, it sounds like. I'm sorry to hear that, Matthew. I mean, I feel the loss, too. I mean, I guess I'm not feeling it quite as...
quite as acutely,
viscerally.
But all right. So with that said, let's just briefly dispense with the Oscars. I got to say that I actually I didn't really watch them, and I haven't even I had promised myself I'd go back and look at the speeches, because but I didn't even do that. So
yeah. I don't think you missed much, Sam, honestly.
Yeah, and I, you know, the idea that Boyhood didn't win for Best Picture, I thought was just ludicrous. But we've had that conversation, haven't we?
You know, I still actually haven't seen Boyhood. I've heard a lot of mixed messages about it. I haven't seen Boyhood. I haven't seen Birdman. None of these films were on my must-see radar, although Boyhood is at the top of any of the Oscar films. So I'm not necessarily too
invested in that. Foxcatcher?
Nope, didn't see Foxcatcher.
I saw that on, I think, the plane ride out or at my hotel. So let's not even talk about – we'll talk about Oscars with somebody else then. I mean, these things –
You had Chris Rosen, who I thought did a very respectable job being a PR flack for Hollywood, and that is what he does. So use the guys with the skills that they got.
Whoa, I love that. I love how you both sounded cheery and gracious – while you stuck the knife, the dagger, right through Chris Rosen's. People did, respond, like, wow, Rosen sounds like he's actually somewhat matured.
Yeah, he was cogent. That's a weird turn for him, but it was surprising in a pleasant way. But, you know, to me, it's like...
I like how you're criticizing him for being cogent. Simultaneously, you're sort of like dissing him for never having been cogent except for this one time, and then criticizing him for being cogent because of what it actually delivered.
Touché. It is what it is. I got to say, sticking a knife in Rosen is like, you know, people who complain about Bill O'Reilly being a liar. It's the same. No one cares. That's what he's there for. The people who listen to that stuff don't really care that it's PR bullshit and it's, you know, stumping for an industry. That's what they want.
Wow. And now you're criticizing Cliff and I for talking about Bill O'Reilly.
Well, no, I'm making the same point that you made, that people who are in that audience don't actually care about the things that you guys are saying. I agree with what you're saying, but same thing.
Let's talk about Marin's show. I did Marin's show.
What was that like?
I don't want to reveal too much of the storyline.
Spoiler alert.
You know, spoiler alert. But I play myself, and it is in the they sort of fictionalized the patent troll battle, or that's why I ostensibly go out there.
Okay. So it still had to be self-serving as Marin as a champion for the podcast people.
Well, there was a little bit of my character was in some instances, I thought, a caricature of me, and in other instances, more of a caricature of Marin's projection of me.
Right. And we all know that his CIA code name is the Projector.
That's right. But it was definitely fun to do. I got to say it was fun. It was also fun to see how there was a little bit on the set. I got the feeling the director, the producers, a little bit of tiptoeing around Marin.
You think anybody that works with Marin day in and day out learns to tiptoe?
Well, I never learned that. And
I know, and I respect you for that. I respect you for that.
Well, I don't think it was really – I don't really know that it's something to respect me for any more than it is, you know, for me to breathe. That's just one of the things
that
I do.
Right.
I was at one point there was a joke that I make in the show about Marin's pants, which is, I think, something that I would used to do back in the day. And I suspect that joke may have been thrown in there by someone who was aware of that. But I realized that not in the show, but even off the show, he was a little bit self-conscious about his pants, about the jeans.
What is he? He's the guy that like takes a bath with his pants on to break him in right and all that.
That's right. It was centered around that. And I realized that in a Pavlovian way, like in a way that was uncontrollable, which I think, you know, it's also indicative of a personality defect on my part. I will cop to that.
Yeah, big of you.
I kept needling him about the pants off the show. So
is this
even
what inspired the person to say that's not helping? I love that story.
Yes, and then the director turned to me and sort of whispered like, "That's not helping."
Helping your performance?
I was like, "Yeah, I know, I know."
Who was the director? Was it Goldthwait?
Selby and me, bro.
No, it wasn't Goldthwait. Okay. It was another guy, Luke. I'm trying to remember his last name. I don't.
Yeah, I know. He's a short film director. I know who you're talking about.
And Goldthwait showed up on one day, you know, because they roll into the next show. I mean, I have to say right. that it's a grueling schedule. It really is yeah. a grueling schedule, and I got to hand it to Mark because he's doing a good job on it, and it is a tough schedule. I mean,
yeah. Well, IFC is not, you know, HBO. They're making a really nice looking show with pretty limited means for what they're
that's,
doing.
That's right. And the interesting thing too, I realized, like, you know, Maron was getting very agitated about the pants, like, you know, and I was, you know, squirting like lighter fluid on the fire. Like, I mean, and I do mean squirting lighter fluid on it. Insofar as, like, if someone's squirting lighter fluid on a fire, you can actually see the flame
trail back to you.
And it occurred to me, you know, and I felt a little bad about it later, where I was like, God, you know, I was taking it. But it occurred to me, I don't even think Maron was conscious of it. I think he, like, didn't even know who was planting this in his head in any way.
It was just, he just received it from the atmosphere as if it was just.
Yeah, I think it was just, he just didn't realize I was sitting there fanning the flames. He just assumed it was, I don't know. That it was
maybe he's just so used to that dynamic between the two of you that it doesn't really, you know, upset him anymore. He just takes it as a granted that when he's with you, there will be some form of that kind of needling.
I think that's possible, but he didn't even like it. Didn't even seem to occur to him that I was doing that. And then it blew over. I mean, I have to say, and the other part that you know, one part that I did find a little bit disturbing is that he clearly is in a much better place.
Really
psychologically and emotionally, and yeah. he's a
that
lot
explains
more...
why I haven't talked to him very much in the last couple of years.
Right. I mean, it's really sort of sad to see that he's really grown emotionally and he's matured, and so that's a little bit disappointing.
Yeah, look, but if Mark can do it, there's hope for all of us, isn't there? I think
yes.
that's a positive way to spin it.
And I did notice in his house far less. You know, he's not featuring as many pictures of himself in the house.
All right.
It's mostly in the garage now, which makes more sense because that's, you know, where the show
design.
Is. And the, yeah, sure. and that's and I did a WTF with him.
Now,
finally.
I want to hear that. How long until that comes out? And I'm sure Brendan will keep in all the juiciest bits.
I don't know when that comes out. And I have to say that it was a little bit weird because it was I felt like we were all over the place, but I'm not really sure. You know,
was he like, all right, you're here. Fine. Do it. Talk.
There was a little bit of a quality to that, but no, he was very gracious. And the weird thing was, I caught him like reading like a Wikipedia. I think it was about like he was reading.
Messed up on you?
Yeah, which I thought was weird. Like, there's not. I've known you for 25 years. There's not enough that you know about me to start a conversation for 45 minutes.
Oh my.
And
I'm sure you guys talked about me, right? You guys, how much of it was me?
I would say about maybe a good 20-25%. Now, I can't promise you that won't be cut out because we did go long. We didn't even talk about Air America.
Oh, my
God. And we talked
for
like 90 minutes. We didn't even talk about Air America, if you can believe it.
Dear God.
I mean, clearly, there needs to be a part two. Right?
That's right. Yeah. Did one of you cry?
I tried to fake cry. But
wow, that's hard for you.
It was there was no jumping off point for me to cry. So
even just being there, no, that didn't bring something up finally.
No.
When was the last time you actually cried, though? You know, maybe that's it.
It's been a long time.
Your kids were born?
Yeah, no, I think I was happy about that.
Tears of joy, you know, tears of joy.
Oh, yeah, tears of joy, right,
yeah.
Okay.
Yeah,
no. I think probably, you know, I think it's possible. The last time I cried, I think, was when I took an airplane and watched the movie, I think.
Oh, okay.
You know, because I think, like, the altitude affects me. And so I could be watching, like, I could watch commercials and cry on an airplane.
Oh, nice.
Yeah.
So you're just a few less molecules of oxygen away from an emotional response.
That's right. That's right. If I'm deprived of oxygen, then I think I could probably have an emotional reaction to something.
That's great. Well, if we ever find you dead of auto asphyxiation, we'll know you were just watching movies.
Right. Well, that's good. I don't know. Wow. That's getting a little dark.
Okay. All right. Sorry.
Speaking of movies, film guy Matthew.
Sorry about that.
Sorry about that. Yeah. Asphyxiation joke.
Sorry about positing how you might die.
Film guy Matthew.
Yes, that's me.
What are you going to recommend for us today?
Well, today, for the listening audience and film fans out there, I'm recommending a brand new film that is out now online on iTunes, Amazon, Movies on Demand, even on YouTube, Google Play, all your best streaming services. Also, it just opened in theaters in New York City this week, and it is called Wild Canaries, directed by Lawrence Michael Levine and starring his wife in real life, Sophia Takal, and a really great cast, including people like Jason Ritter, Alia Shawkat from Arrested Development, Annie Parisi, and you know, other character actors you might recognize like Kevin Corrigan. And it is a Brooklyn set, basically murder mystery comedy. It's a bit of a love letter to movies like The Thin Man and Manhattan Murder Mystery, where it's sort of a wacky screwball comedy about a couple. The husband is very sort of straight-laced and uptight, and the wife is sort of ditzy and high energy, and they think that they may have discovered a murder in their Brooklyn brownstone, and they set about trying to solve it, meanwhile negotiating their impending nuptials, which is a really great aspect of the film. It's sort of a relationship comedy disguised as a murder mystery disguised as a relationship comedy. And it has some elements of the sort of mumblecore style. Lawrence Levine made another movie I recommended once called Gabby on the Roof in July with Sophia Takal, and she made a movie called Green, which got a lot of, both of them got a lot of great reviews that were sort of in that mumblecore genre. And this is a step up in the level of sort of filmmaking, and it's sort of a genre film, even for which is a departure for these guys. And it comes off really great. It is hilarious. And I do know the filmmakers. They're old friends, but this movie was very impressive. Mm-hmm. And I, in full disclosure, but it's gotten amazing reviews. It's got like almost like a 90% rating on Rotten Tomatoes right now.
Wow. And, now, wait a second. Now, what's the name of the movie again?
Wild Canaries.
It's interesting because to a certain extent, I mean, this, you know, before you told me you knew these people, it sounded a little bit of a pedestrian pick for you.
Right.
And I've never heard you actually having to sort of to cite Wild Tomatoes or whatever that is.
It's Wild Canaries.
No, or what is it?
Rotten Tomatoes.
Yeah, that seems a little suspect to me, I got to say.
Well, I wouldn't recommend a film of a friend of mine's if I didn't also actually believe it to be really great. And this one was really impressive, and, you know, it got me to, you know, it's not just a wacky comedy. It has some really insightful and truthful moments between the couple as they're sort of starting to freak out about getting married to each other. You understand, Sam, how you get nervous when it gets close to being the real thing, and you start to wonder, like, who is this person I'm committing to spend the rest of my life with? So while you're laughing at the sort of wacky hijinks, you're getting sort of an insight into, like, you know what? Everyone goes through this thing. I can marry this person that I think is crazy, and it is part of the process to accept that aspect of each other. And so it's actually a very well-done and insightful film. It is not just some crappy thing that I'm just shilling for because I know the filmmakers. Not at all.
Now, Matthew, I mean, I want to dig a little deeper into this, okay?
Dig away.
Is it not the case that you are engaged?
Oh, yes. Yes, it is. I am engaged.
Okay. So this is getting a little bit more suspect as we go on because...
Why suspect? I'm just saying I can relate to the kind of existential anxieties that an impending marriage brings up.
Are you trying to send a message to us or perhaps to your fiance by recommending this film?
Only in that I understand that I am difficult to live with and that I have my foibles that need to be accepted by any prospective wife, and that this kind of anxiety is natural and does not in any way pretend a relationship is not worth having. No, that's not a signal I'm sending at all, but just that it's something that we can all be more at peace with when we start to have those kinds of thoughts and fears. But no, my relationship is quite solid, and our wedding is quite impending.
Okay, so what I hear are two things. One, that you are, you've been practicing being sensitive to your fiancé, which is good. And two, I'm starting to hear that she has some cold feet.
Not at all.
Are you sure?
Not at all. We just bought a couch. We just bought a brand new couch together. That's really something. And we're looking into getting a dog.
Where did you get the couch? Where did you get the couch? Was it an IKEA couch?
No, Lazy Boy. Big time.
Ooh, all right. Oh, okay. Okay.
Yeah.
So wait, did you get one of those couches that has like separate seats that recline?
Yeah, baby.
Oh, wow. Now, does
that
fit in your place in Queens?
So where do you live now? Out in Long Island? Suffolk County?
Astoria.
Yeah. How is that fitting in there?
Now, does that, yeah, exactly. I mean, does it have like the drink, the built-in drink holders?
No, I couldn't get the drink. Don't have room for that. You know, I got 64 inches. Very good.
All right. There you go. And so can you put it right up against the wall?
You got to keep a 4-inch gap for it to fully recline because it sort of slides forward and back, but it doesn't go back that far. You
4 inches
is
not very much. It's the technology for these things has just been so it's been amazing. The improvements.
Oh, it's incredible! It's the best thing that ever happened to
us. Well, congratulations on the couch.
Thanks.
Thank you so much for the suggestion of Wild Canaries.
Yeah,
Michael, did you
want
to add something to?
No, the time has passed.
Oh, all right. Oh. Sorry. Yeah.
Are you sure?
Oh, yeah, no, I'm sure. I'm sure. The time is fine.
Oh, okay.
It wouldn't be funny anymore.
Okay. All right. Michael's
hasn't
be
stopped you before.
Wow. All right. Well, we get
it. I love how psychological maturity is rewarded on this program.
Michael's.
Yeah. That comes straight from the top, you know.
Yes, exactly. A fish gets mature from the head down, I think is the saying.
Is that it? Yeah, that's like a Zen Cohen, I think.
Matthew, as always, a huge pleasure. I hope to see you soon. It's been too long.
The pleasure is mine, Sam. Yes, I hope to see you soon.
I'm going
to
get you back in studio, I think.
All right, that sounds like a plan.
All right, buddy. I'll talk to you soon. Thanks so much.
Talk to you later, guys. Bye-bye.
Wild Canaries, ladies and gentlemen. Wild Canaries. All right, well, let's pull the plug on this thing and go to the fun half.
Oh, okay. Sure.
Should we not?
I mean, I could play it really quick and we come right back in.
Yeah,
I think freebies have got enough.
Yeah, we're going to do another.
Let's not waste any time with the song. Yeah, let's do it.
Let's do it. What happened? Oh, there we go.